song is called Simeon's Joy, done by Daniel Rose. Good morning to you. About 14 minutes now past the hour on this Wednesday, and it is a Wednesday, and that means we enjoy a visit from Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times. And Doug is with us from, is it Gaithersburg or is it Columbia?
Gaithersburg is the post office box, but Columbia is where we have the office.
Oh,
and
gotcha.
As I look out the window here, White Christmas does not seem to be in the cards at the moment.
Well, we'll see if we can send you some along, because we got enough to spare here.
Is that
just
right?
By coincidence, yeah. And I guess a good bit of Minnesota getting more today, although we're exempted. We got a little bit yesterday. Gaithersburg, Maryland, Columbia, Maryland, on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. That's the headquarters of Preserving Bible Times. It's a ministry. It's been around since, mid-'80s, Doug?
Formally, since about 2002.
Oh, okay. But informally before that, because
there were a lot of things going on before that. You're absolutely right.
And of course, the mission is to bring back the historic and cultural context of first century Hebrew understandings to our understanding of Scripture. And we look forward to these conversations so much. Last week we covered a whole lot of ground. We're heavily into Advent, which is entirely appropriate. But Doug has a little different take on really where the story begins, and we take you now to an aging couple, weren't they, Zechariah and Elizabeth? They were getting along in years.
Well, Luke takes us there, and his first chapter sets the stage for Luke 2, the birth narratives of Jesus. And I think once you get up about 5,000 feet and start looking at Luke 1, it really is a fascinating passage all by itself. I think we tend to be in a hurry to blow through Luke 1 so we can get to Luke 2 and the birth narratives. But we need to remember that Luke uses this couple to set what I would call a universal stage or a universal story. When you think about it, this aged couple, when we meet them here, have unfulfilled longings. And everyone in this land has unfulfilled longings. Almost every Jew worth his salt and DNA has this longing to get these pagan Romans out of this land. There's a longing for Messiah. God has been silent, basically, for about 400 years since the end of Malachi. And then we got this couple, and they're waiting. They probably have waited too long in their own eyes for something so right, so good, the birth of a son that just never came along. And so my first suggestion here is when we start to dig into Zechariah and Elizabeth, we have to identify with them as if we are them. Because 9 out of 10 of us, I hate to say 10 out of 10, that's an absolute statement, but 9 out of 10 of us, life hasn't turned out like we hoped and dreamed it would. And that's the storyline of Zechariah and Elizabeth. They are still waiting with unfulfilled longings. Most of us are still waiting for something that seems so right, so good, that just never seemed to come along. And so the story of this couple is a universal story. I think it speaks to almost all of us when we look at it through that prism. And that's why I think it's really a fascinating story to start to contextually put back in place and understand just what was their predicament, what were they dealing with, and how does that speak to us today?
And Doug, just a word, if you can pull your mic down a little bit too, where you're feeling sounding a little distant today. There you go. This is a fascinating story. And tell us about Zechariah in the scheduling and how that work within the temple went, because he was a priest. Had been for many years, and he was feeling a little left out, wasn't he?
Well, I think before we get there, I think we have to back up and put quite a bit of context in place. You know, as best I can tell, when Zechariah was born, it was within a year or two, or maximum three, from 63 BC, when Pompey and the Roman 10th Legion entered this land. And when pagan Rome began to rule this land. We need to understand that from a Jewish worldview perspective, Rome is the kingdom of evil. Satan is Rome's chief operating officer. And so as Zechariah's father, whose name we do not know, looks across this land, hears the cry of a baby, waits expectantly, hoping it's a boy, The midwife then probably tells him, yes, it is a boy. He's a priest, and only priests can give birth to future priests. And so his dream and hope would have been that I would have a son who could carry on the priestly line of our family. And so when he finds out it's a boy, I'm guessing roughly 60 BC, his next task is to pick a name. And I think we pick names in our culture for all kinds of reasons. But back then, naming a son, a child, particularly a son, was a very sacred and solemn task. And so he gives this newborn baby the name Zechariah, which means whom Jehovah remembers. And it may be that his father used that from a national perspective. Jehovah, remember this land, remember your people. But it was a chosen name that Zechariah was given that is going to become very ironic in his future years, because he's going to start walking through life, I'm convinced, feeling that God has forgotten him, and the irony of his name, whom Jehovah remembers. Anyway, so having given birth to a son, I suspect Zechariah's father raised his son to remember the meaning of his name. He probably told him the backdrop of why he was named Zechariah so many times that Zechariah felt he could recite that story backwards and forwards. And I suspect as Zechariah got to be around 12, 13, 14, 15 years of age, his father said, you know, his birth was special, and I need to get him a special wife. And so he negotiates, he talks, he discusses. And one day he comes home to his little home, tradition says, in Ein Kerem, a village probably about 5 or 6 miles from Jerusalem. And he says to Elizabeth, such a deal I did today. I have got a wife for Zechariah. Her name is Elizabeth. What a wonderful name. She's of the clan of Aaron, which means Aaron was Israel's first high priest. Mm-hmm. He said, this is special. What a special wife. This is going to be a special couple. I wonder what the Lord has in store for them. And so already I can just sense in the background here high expectations being placed on this couple to be. Well, anyway, they have their wedding feast, finally, if things go according to tradition in that culture. Zechariah would have been about 20 and Elizabeth would have been about age 13. They would have waited for her to start to menstruate, because a woman's role in this culture is to procreate. I think that's something we miss when we go back into this passage. A woman's job is to have a fruitful womb. Beyond that, the rabbis have taught, if God likes you, you will have a fruitful womb. You will have many children. And particularly if you're a priest, you will have many sons. And so we get this backdrop here of expectations. And the moment typically that we define an expectation, we've probably defined our disappointment as well. But anyway, the time comes for the wedding feast, and it's a multi-day event. And I'm sure Zechariah's father, as he watched the wedding feast unfold, said, what a special couple. I wonder how many children they're going to have. And especially, I wonder how many priestly sons they're going to have. And my guess is that Zechariah and Elizabeth probably had that same thought as they finished up their multi-day wedding feast and they launched into life as a married couple, just getting ready to have all those priestly sons.
I'm trying to imagine a 20-year-old and a 30. We have a whole different idea of marriage over here, don't we? And Mary, about the same age, likely 13, 14.
If Mary and Joseph were of traditional ways of doing things, yes, that would have been typically what we would expect those ages to be. And we need to remember also that the average age that people lived was 42 years. So, you know, much lower than our 72 years today. Mm-hmm. So the sooner you got at it, so to speak, the better off you were going to be.
So the longer you could get to know your own kids and shepherd them and guide them and teach them, raise them in the tradition of the culture in your area. Okay, so they got married and they're off into life. And Zechariah, when would he have begun his priestly duties? Now, if he was about 20 when he got married, was he actively involved with the temple at that point?
Some discussion about that. Some would say it starts at 20 and runs for 30 years. Some would say it starts at 30 and runs for 30 years. The 30-year duration, we know, is fixed. We're just not quite sure when it started. So, you know, if you want to take a midpoint there of 25 and add 30 years to it, you retired, so to speak, at age 55, obviously well beyond age 42. But here's what I want us to catch up to. This couple is married, and so obviously they start paying attention to procreation. And so 1 year goes by, and 2 years goes by, and then 5 years goes by, and that's, what, 60 attempts at procreation and 60 failures. And in this culture, we need to factor in a few other things here. This is observant Judaism. The rabbis and their Pharisees are in control. They interpret God's word authoritatively for the people. And a number of rabbis have ruled something like this. There are only two reasons, two things that could happen in your life by which you could not say that God was disciplining you because he loves you and cares for you. And those two conditions are leprosy and childlessness. And so if you're a leper and if you're childless to this culture, it's a prima facie statement that God doesn't like you. You have offended God, and he has basically turned his back on you. Well, you know, that doesn't show up immediately. I suspect it didn't show up 5 years into their marriage. I don't know when it would have showed up. But there comes a moment in time when the clan and the culture looks at this couple and says, okay, 8 years, 9 years, 10 years is enough. You're not pregnant. You never have been pregnant. We know God doesn't like you. And this is what I think we really miss and what really is profound about this portion of Luke 1. What is it like to go through life every day with your culture and your clan and your neighborhoods convinced that God doesn't like you?
Well, it would be awful. And especially to be lumped with lepers. It kind of is useless to your society, I suppose. And how must this have affected the work of Zechariah? I mean, he's a priest.
You know, let's call Elizabeth a social leper. Hmm. Every day she walks to the well, probably alone. And every day her neighbors and her clan, you know, lean out their door and say, oh, there goes Zach, there goes Elizabeth. She thinks he's righteous, but we know better. Because it is an inviolatable rule. If God doesn't like you, you will be barren. And so this now sets the stage for Luke chapter 1, verse 6. He's talking about Zechariah and Elizabeth, and this is what Luke tells us. They were both righteous in the sight of God, walking blamelessly, which is a present tense tense treatment there of the word blamelessly, in all the commandments and requirements of the Lord. And so that verse just leaps out. How in the world can you be righteous before God and yet childless? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't fit. Something's wrong with that verse if we get into the world of first century observant Judaism. And so that's the dilemma, that's the burden that Zechariah and Elizabeth carry. They are righteous, and yet their whole culture looks at them and said, you have offended God. God doesn't like you. And what is it like to walk through life day after day being misunderstood and realizing there is absolutely nothing you can do about it? I think that's one of the hardest burdens in life.
And of course, we've talked about this culture of God dislikes you being endemic to the culture. The religious establishment enforced that on not only lepers and childless couples, but any kind of a physical deformity. said that God didn't like you. And in a theocracy, I mean, that's your whole country turning their backs on you.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to go against the religious establishment when they are the culture, and they control everything. All right, so let's freeze that thought. And now we've got Zechariah. And in the fifth verse of Luke 1, we're told that he is of the division of Abiah. And we know from history that there are 24 divisions of priest, ordinary priest. The estimates of how many ordinary priests there were in the land in the first century varies between a low of 12,000 and a high of 20,000. Let's take 12,000 and let's divide it by 24. And that gets us 500. Is that right?
Yep, 500.
Yeah, about right. 500 priests per clan, all right? And so there are so many priests that you've got to share the duties. And so every 24 weeks, one of these clans is on duty in the temple in Jerusalem, and then they're off for 23 weeks, except many of them all come back together for the major festivals when there's a high logistical infrastructure need at the temple. So 500 priests show up to serve a week. Well, they divide that by at least five or six. So let's break that down into 100 priests per day. And then there are a number of offerings that have to be given, and they have to be staffed. And the most prestigious offering is called the incense offering. It's the third event of the day. It occurs at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's considered the most honorary offering for a priest to serve at, because you walk into the holy place and you are on this side of the massive veil that separates the holy place from the holy of holies. Okay. So this, to serve in the incense offering, is so prestigious that if you're selected, you can only do this once in your lifetime. Every 24 weeks, Zechariah goes with his clan to Jerusalem, and maybe they're on Tuesday duty or Wednesday duty, not that it matters, but they will assemble themselves in a place called the Court of Hewn Stone, which is in the basement, so to speak, of Temple Mount, and the president of their clan will arrange all of the priests in a circle. Let's envision 100 of them. And then he will declare a number, like 87. And then after having declared the number, he will walk over to a priest that he has chosen and take his headpiece off. And that priest will count one, and they'll go around the circle until the 87th priest is identified. And then that's the priest that will do the incense offering that day. That is how they cast lots, is how it's phrased in a lot of Bibles, for who would be chosen. Okay? Now, so figure this through. Zechariah, in years 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe even 29 years, has never been chosen. Okay? And his wife never gets pregnant. And I wonder how many of those years he walked back and forth from the temple to Ein Kerim, and then 23 weeks later from Ein Kerim back to the temple, meditating again on his name, whom Jehovah remembers. And my goodness, do we ever feel like a forgotten couple.
Well, and individually too, Doug. I mean, as a priest who's already got the reputation with his wife as not being liked by God, to have that to verified in God's not, I mean, there's a choice by lot, was the attempt to have God make the decision, or at least they could confer the choice, is leaving it to God to decide, the so-called randomness of it. He must have felt totally left out and totally ostracized.
And it gets reinforced each successive year, because let's say after the 20th year, a lot of the colleagues that were in his class, if you will, incoming class, are gone because they've already been chosen. Each year, the new newly minted priest come into the circle. And so by the time here he gets close to retirement after 30 years of service, he's probably the only gray beard, you know, in the circle. All of the other priests are much, much younger than he is. He really would have stood out conspicuously. So he's probably about to retire, the way we sort of deduce this here. Maybe he's got a year left. Maybe this is his last year. They go into the chamber of hewn stone. The lot casting process unfolds, and lo and behold, he is selected. What do you think he might have been feeling and thinking at that moment in time?
Well, that's a good question. I could kind of imagine it must have been a very emotional time. Probably thoughts of his name coming to maybe God has not forgotten me.
Perhaps I would suggest maybe even fear and trembling.
Well, yes.
Maybe now, as I'm about to retire, I'm going to find out what we've done to offend God. I'm not sure I want to deal with this. Whoa. What beats me? Don't know. Maybe both feelings. That's just put him in an ambivalent state. So anyway, when it comes time for the 3 o'clock in the afternoon incense offering, he gets two helpers. They get a silver bowl and a gold bowl. They go over to the main altar and they get some red hot coals, and they carry them in to the holy place, and they dump them out onto the top of the incense offering, little mini platform here. And then a spice mix of four spices is shaken on top of these coals, and these spices start to burn. And one of the spices is called frankincense, and it's Lavona, and it has the peculiar attribute that as soon as it burns, it creates a very white smoke, and that's supposed to indicate purity. And it starts to ascend upward, and that's supposed to represent the ascending prayers of the people. And as that's going on, as that's unfolding, suddenly here's this angel. And what do you think Zechariah is thinking at this moment in time?
Well, shock. I mean, you don't get reports out of the temple every day that an angel has appeared. I guess he's figuring how he's going to digest this, how he's going to explain this, and listen, and very intently listening, I would think.
Now I'm going to know what we've done to offend God. Here comes God's messenger to tell me.
So his reaction would have been the angel was there to speak to him personally then.
I don't know. None of us know. I'm just trying to get into all the context here and sort of deduce. Mm-hmm. It could have been very fearful, obviously, occurrence for all kinds of reasons. But if he could have collected himself, and it doesn't appear that he did, he would have instantly realized that God had not forgotten him. There he is with an angel who is announcing to him that Messiah is about to come, the first person to hear that news. And it's fascinating what his reaction is. How can this be? I am an old man. He responds from the perspective of biology.
We're old.
Son, I can't have a son. Mm-hmm. My wife is way past those age, you know, menopause, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So your supposition, your possibility of thought that when he first saw the angel, the first thought he had in his mind is, ooh, I'm about to find out. This is probably not good.
That's sort of where I'm leaning. But we have to just realize that it's just conjecture. But what is recorded here is he's heard that Messiah is going to come, that his son is going to lead the way, prepare the way. And rather than reacting in praise and adoration, he says, how can this be? I'm an old man. I can't procreate anymore, and neither can my wife. He's very consumed by biology. And that's sometimes very true of us, isn't it? We hear something, but we really don't listen to it. The words, but we really don't grasp it because we're focused on something smaller, something much more intensely personal, and we miss the bigger message because we're so preoccupied with our issues today.
Well, and the other part of it too, Doug, is that this is not just an average Joe walking around in the street who, you know, lays bricks for a living. This is a guy who lives in the priesthood. He is a, he is cheek and jowl with all of this. And this is supposedly one of the true believers. And his first assumption when he sees a heavenly being is to say, God can't be that. It's got to be this.
Yeah. He's just been told he's going to have fun. And basically what he said is, I don't believe that. I mean, that's unbelief. And so he pays a price for that. I mean, there are consequences for unbelief. And so he is struck, most commentators feel here, or at least many do, both deaf and dumb. Okay? And now it's part of the tradition here, part of the protocol, that after you've done the incense offering, you come out on this platform that overlooks the Nicanor steps that go down into the temple, the court of Israel. And then there's some more steps that go down into the court of the women. And while Zechariah is in there, everyone who's worshiping is prostrate on the ground. And they're all waiting for Zechariah to come out and pronounce the Aaronic benediction. And lo and behold, he doesn't come out when he's supposed to. He's delayed. What's going on? What's taking so long? And then he finally comes out, and he cannot speak the benediction. I'm guessing here, probably the first time in the history of the temple that the officiating priest of the incense offering could not give the benediction. Talk about instant notoriety from someone who, for the last 29 years, has been felt that he had been absolutely passed over, forgotten. Suddenly, he's the talk of the temple. And then he has to go home and explain to Elizabeth what's happened and what the promise is. And so, if you permit me a little humor here, I would reason that somewhere walking back to his home, he found a slate, something he could write on, maybe a piece of chalk. And he walks in the front door, and Elizabeth greets him, and she hears no sounds in return. And, you know, it doesn't take her long to realize that something is profoundly different here about Zechariah. And, Zach, my good man, are you deaf? I mean, say something. And he's moving with his hands, trying to explain what happens, and then he starts to try to write it out on the slate. And there comes a moment in time when he writes on this slate, Liz, we need to try it one more time. And did she just burst into, you know?
I thought you were going to tell me he wrote, Hi, honey, I'm home.
Yeah.
And she responded, try what?
Well, something happened because she became pregnant, and lo and behold, the notoriety of Zechariah has spread all over. The community now knows that something special is going on in Elizabeth's womb, and all of a sudden, Elizabeth is the talk of the town. And that is often God's way of doing it. He inverts things. He takes those who are at the bottom and places them on top. Those that are last shall be first. And she and Zechariah are now very, very special people. But now, we don't have that much time left, but let me weave one other thing into here. As Luke 1 unfolds the story, he gets to verse 26. And suddenly he shifts the scene from presumably Ein Kerim, where Zechariah and Elizabeth are living, and he goes to Nazareth, and we deal with the Annunciation of Mary. And Mary is told, and behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall name him Jesus, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. And Mary says to the angel, how can this be since I am a virgin? Verse 34. Now, I just want to pause here. To be conceived, let's say, out of spiritual wedlock here, is not good news to Mary. Presumably, she's a 12-and-a-half-year-old girl. She hasn't yet start to menstruate, or there would have been a wedding feast with Joseph. And now she finds out she's going to become pregnant, even though she's betrothed. Her instant concern here is one of perceived adultery. Her concern is that Joseph would go straight back to the scribe who wrote the betrothal agreement, the marriage contract, and immediately write a writ of divorce. that would put a scarlet letter on her forehead for the rest of her days. No other man would ever marry her. Her son would be known officially in the genealogical records as the B son of Miriam. And being the B son of Miriam, he would be forbidden to marry. Just as a side here, that just blows the whole theory of the Da Vinci Code that Jesus married Mary Magdalene. And every dream and hope that Mary would have had about being a soccer mom and a den mother and a Girl Scout, you know, coordinator is gone. All of her hopes and dreams are destroyed at that moment in time with this good news, quote unquote. So what does the angel do in verse 35? The angel answered and said to her, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will be overshadow you, and for that reason the Holy Child shall be called the Son of God." Verse 36, "And behold, even your relative Elizabeth has also conceived a son in her old age. She who was called barren is now in her sixth month, for nothing will be impossible with God." The Holy Spirit and the angel here are using Elizabeth's case history to inspire Mary. That is as grim as your future may seem to you, I want you to know nothing is impossible with God. Even your relative Elizabeth is pregnant. And she would have known of Elizabeth's state. And that causes Mary to respond in verse 38. "And Mary said, behold, the bond slave of the Lord, may it be done to me according to your word." She accepts her destiny and the inspiration of Elizabeth, and being very knowledge of her case history, inspires to her to say, "Let it be done to me as you have said." Observation. Do we actually live each day as if we are a walking case history of faith that other people are watching and could be inspired by? That's what I really like here about this juxtaposition of Elizabeth and Mary in these verses. And here's another thought. Finally, Elizabeth understands why she had to wait so long to conceive, because Mary hadn't even been born yet for most of those years. And God is gracious here in giving Elizabeth a glimpse through the rearview mirror of why all those years of waiting, why all those years of being misunderstood. Because he was at work, God was at work, doing something incredibly special, and they had a very special role to play in his plan. It's really an uplifting and inspiring case history.
Boy, it is, and several more pieces of that Advent puzzle just fall into place there. It's amazing how all of history is tied together under God's wing. He's managed the whole thing, and he picks the people he's going to use, and it just doesn't make any difference. Our view of what they've done, what they've accomplished, who they are, just doesn't make any difference because God's at the center. Fascinating stuff. And Doug, as always, we're grateful to you. Next week, day after Christmas, I don't know if you'd be available.
I should be available.
Okay. Well, we'll plan on it at this point. And there's a lot more to the story to continue. Doug Greenwald with Preserving Bible Times. You can link to preservingbibletimes.org from our website, brokenroadradio.com, right over there on the right-hand side of the homepage. It's a valuable resource for your church and for your Bible studies, and even just personally, you might want to head on over there to preservingbibletimes.org at some point. And Doug, we're getting excited about your trip out to our neck of the woods in April. We've got an organizational meeting today. Some more churches are getting wind of your coming here, and we'll see how this all pans out. But we're excited to have you.
I'm excited about that, and just keep the snow 2 footer.
I'll see if we can arrange 70 degrees of sunshine for you. But
much of the snow should be gone in April, but that's not a guarantee.
There's no guarantees in Minnesota, not at all. Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times. Doug, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Okay,
and
bye.
Music continues on our Broken Road Radio Wednesday from First Call. Good morning to you.